I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 3:17. Members present are Representatives Nelson, Carrick, Freer, Fields, and Hall. We have a quorum. Please silence your cell phones. Thank you, Andrew Magnuson, LNC Committee Secretary, Renzo Moises from the Juneau LIO. We have three bills on the agenda. HB 329, Electric Utility Certificate of Fitness by the House CRNA Committee. HB 363, Alcohol Sales by Patriotic Organizations by Rep. Stutz. And HB 305, Transportation Network Company Driver Pay, which I introduced. First up, HB 329, Electric Utility Certificate of Fitness by House CRNA. Thank you, Representative Mears and Mr. Plush. Please come up and present the bill.
Thank you very much, House Labor and Commerce, Co-Chairs Fields and Hall, for hearing our bill today. I am Representative Donna Mears from South Muldoon, House District 21 in East Anchorage. House Bill 329 clarifies the longstanding certificate of fitness exemption for communities under 2,500 population to ensure that multi-community utilities like the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative can continue to use a local workforce to keep costs low and prevent long outages. AS 1862010, as written, exempts workers doing electrical work for electric utilities in communities with a population under 2,500 from needing certificates of fitness. This has allowed rural utilities to use local labor for basic electric distribution upkeep where there are not certificated linemen. AVEC mainly serves communities under 2,500, and like other rural utilities, they have used this exemption to keep the lights on. Only one AVEC community has a population over 2,500, Bethel. AVEC took over as Bethel's electric utility in 2014, and they have used certificated linemen there since, while continuing to use uncertificated local workers elsewhere. This past summer, they had to stop this practice as the Department of Labor and Workforce Development issued a cease and desist to AVEC, letting them know that the statute, as written, requires all AVEC workers doing relevant work in all 58 communities to have certificates of fitness just because of AVEC's non-continuous service area includes a single community over 2,500, Bethel. As you will hear from Bill Stamm at AVEC, this exemption has been critical to keep the lights on in remote Alaska communities. This bill seeks to maintain the status quo for AVEC's operations by clarifying the statute, which is how we were told we need to fix this situation. AVEC is beginning to grapple with the added costs and delays caused by the department's revocation of this exemption, and it's important we act quickly to prevent this revocation from worsening the reliability and continuing to increase the cost to AVEC customers. So I believe you want to read a quick sectional, and then we'll get to our testimony.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, my name is Griffin Plush. For the record, I'm staff to Representative Mears. Section 1 of the bill amends AS 18.62.010 and changes and clarifies the current exemption allowing employees of electric utilities that serve rural remote communities with a population under 2,500 to perform electrical work without a certificate of fitness. The clarification focuses on two criteria. First, it ensures that the existing exemption applies to portions of service areas that are not electrically interconnected and under 2,500 population. And second, it ensures that the exemption applies to municipal or tribal government employees working on behalf of the utility. Section 2 defines qualified employee. This section adopts a definition based on Occupational Safety and Health Administration regulation for application of the term qualified employees in Section 1.
Okay. Should we turn to invited testimony?
Yes, please.
Okay. First up in invited testimony is Bill Stamm, CEO of AVEC. Mr. Stamm is on Teams, I believe. Thank you for being here, Mr. Stamm, and please proceed.
Thank you. For the record, Bill Stamm, President and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Thank you, Co-Chair Fields and Hall, for hearing this testimony. And I guess thank you very much to Representative Mears and the Community and Regional Affairs for bringing this to the legislature and doing the heavy lift and describing the details of the bill. I guess I'll jump in with a little bit of background on AVEC. Alaska Village Electric Cooperative is a member-owned, non-for-profit electric utility serving 58 rural communities. That population total is about 31,000, about the same as Fairbanks or Juneau, but it's spread all over Alaska. Our communities are in Southeast, on Kodiak Island, Nunavak Island, St. Lawrence Island, and all up and down the West Coast, the major river systems of Alaska. Only one of the communities we serve is accessible by road, and that's Mento, about 3 hours north of Fairbanks. Most of these systems are distinct individual communities. We have joined a few of the communities together, probably one of the largest conglomerations, I guess, of communities. There's four communities on the Yukon River, St. Mary's, Mountain Village, Andreski, and Pickus Point. Total combined population there is still under 2,500, but it does serve a number of communities. So we have 46 power plants serving 58 communities, and we do use local workforce to operate and maintain our systems. We have local power plant operators that are essentially part-time employees that maintain the power plant, check it at least three times a day, make sure that the engines are running properly, that they're running the right engine for the right load, and they do respond to issues that pop up either at the power plant or in the distribution system. If we have a service complaint, the first person on scene is usually the power plant operator to go out and check a service. If there is a blown fuse somewhere in the system, we do have fuses in our power distribution system. We call them cutouts. If there's a blown fuse due to a line slap, weather issue, overload, anything like that, these power plant operators have been trained to suit up and replace those fuses. They operate from the ground with an insulated hot stick and essentially restore power in short order. By adhering to the law as it is written now and as is being interpreted by the Department of Labor, we can no longer employ these people to do work on our power distribution systems. The training that we've provided them will be discontinued because they can't utilize it, and our response times to provide any sort of maintenance or repair to these systems has grown tremendously. As you can probably appreciate, working in Juneau and possibly living somewhere else, it takes a while to get from point A to point B in Alaska. It costs a significant amount of money. And as things are now, if we blow a fuse in Tuxuk Bay and we have a journeyman working in Russian Mission, he would have to shut down his job in Russian Mission and pack up 300 or 400 pounds of gear, put it on a small plane, fly to a hub, disembark, put all of his gear on another small plane, fly to the new location, and do about an hour's worth of work after 4, 8, maybe 16 or 32 hours of travel, depending on weather, those sorts of things. So we are not only delaying the time it takes to repair things, it's costing quite a bit more to respond in that fashion, and it's putting additional pressure on the few linemen that we do have. It's already a difficult task to travel in rural Alaska and work in these remote locations. When you step up the amount of travel that we've had to do over the last 6 months, it's creating additional strain. I guess I'll stand aside and ask if there's any questions. I don't know if you're going to do questions immediately or at the end.
I think we can do questions right now, if that's okay with you, Mr. Sam. Representative Colomb and then Sadler have questions.
Yeah, so thank you, through the chair. So you said there's 46 power plants. Are all those power plants pretty similar in what they run on and how they run?
Through the chair, Representative Coulomb, they are similar in that they are all primarily diesel generation. We do have integrated renewable generation, wind turbines and solar panels in 14 different locations serving 20 communities. But the backbone of all of our generation is small diesel power plants. They range in size, the engines range in size from 100 kW to about a megawatt or 1,000 kW. And the one that's the outlier in that, again, is the community of Bethel, where we have six 2.2 megawatt generators serving the community. Three are usually online at one time, sometimes four, sometimes five. But the size of Bethel and its operation is completely different than the communities, the other communities we serve.
Can I follow up? So I'm understanding that the bill, if you're in Bethel, you still need the certificate of fitness, and the other communities, you would not need a certificate of fitness. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Coulomb. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Stan. Thank you. Have you any idea why the exemption was written as it was that is causing the problem right now?
I don't. Obviously, when we were given this notice, we did try to look into the history of the original statute and came up dry. Had some legal folks looking to see if there were notes. So it's open to interpretation, I guess, at this point.
Okay. Mysterious indeed are the ways of the legislature, but follow up?
Sure.
Very good. Another question is there any level of work that deserves to continue to require a repair person to have a certificate of fitness? I think that the general assumption we have is that there's smaller level repair work that has to be done that does not require a COF qualified person and all the associated logistical challenges. But is there any level of work that really should get a certificate of fitness electrician to repair?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, certainly, yes. And we do employ certificated linemen to do that work in smaller communities. It is incumbent on the utility to provide a safe workplace, adhere to all of the regulations of OSHA. There's a 1910-269 standard that everybody works under, providing adequate training and proper equipment, those sorts of things, in order to do any of the work that we do. The certificate of fitness is an additional license that's provided by the state of Alaska to recognize essentially journey level work or training. So certificate of fitness can be issued to a plumber or to an electrician or to a journey lineman. So yes, absolutely. And we do employ certificated people with certificates of fitness in those communities, but we select when that work gets done and we can deploy them. Obviously, if there's a bunch of lines down and the trees have wreaked havoc, there's some initial work that can be done by the local operators as far as clearing trees and de-energizing lines, those sorts of things. But the reconstruction of something like that would be certificated linemen.
Yeah. I've got more, but I'll defer.
Yes, I might just jump in here, Mr. Stam. So Representative Coulomb was asking about your service area, and as I recall, your service area has grown. And my assumption is that's because AVAC is able to bring both economies of scale and capacity to a growing number of communities around the state. Could you just give us a little bit of context of how much AVAC service area has grown over the last, say, decade, and why it has been advantageous for more communities to be part of what has become a really robust statewide network?
Yeah, Representative Fields, I guess going all the way back to inception in 1968, AVEC was formed around four communities that got together. They were in disparate parts of the state, southeast, Kodiak Island, west coast, and up in northern area, northwest Alaska. But in 10 or so years, that four grew to 40, and then since that time, we've continued to increase up to 58. In the last 10 years, there has not been that many. I'd say maybe a half a dozen or so in the last 10 years that have joined for a variety of reasons. But yes, AVAC does enjoy some level of economies of scale. We still feel the pain points of trying to generate on such a small scale in each individual location, but we do enjoy the fact that we can share resources, administration, engineering, project development, response with certificated linemen when needed, those sorts of things to provide a more robust fabric that can provide reliable energy in these small communities.
Thank you, Mr. Stam. Representative Carrick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Stam. I'm not sure if this is for you or the bill sponsor, but are there any other utilities that were this last year put in the same position with this new interpretation? Or is it just AVAC? And if you could maybe elaborate a little bit about, from what you know, why this exemption was not applied to AVAC?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, in a strict reading of the statute as it is, I believe they've got the interpretation right. We could argue over what's considered a service area in the statute, but thought it would be cleaner to say, let's just change the language in order to make it clear where the exemption would apply and where it would not. I guess I'm not entirely certain what motivated the statement from Department of Labor. I'm not aware also of any other utilities that are affected at this point. There are other multi-community utilities within the state, but I don't know that any of them straddle that boundary. Alaska Power and Telephone is an employee-owned for-profit utility, and I think they serve about 40 communities. There's other cooperatives that serve handfuls of communities around the state, but I don't think any of those presently have that same, haven't stepped over the threshold where they have at least one community that's more than 2,500 in population.
Okay, I think what we're going to do, Representative Sadler, is go to the next invited testifier, and then we will circle back for more committee member questions. Next up in invited testimony is Ted Swanson. Mr. Swanson, please proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Co-Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Ted Swanson, and I'm one of the business representatives of IBW Local 1547 in Alaska. I'll begin by thanking the committee for the opportunity to testify regarding HB 329. The IBW represents thousands of electrical workers across the state in the construction industry, as well as small and large electrical utilities. IBW members place a high value on professional licensing, especially the electrical trade license, known as the Certificate of Fitness in Alaska. In our industry, the Certificate of Fitness requires that electricians and power linemen have had at least 8,000 hours of training in their field, and that they take a competency exam before they're able to work as journeymen and women. Electrical work is inherently hazardous, and the Certificate of Fitness ensures that workers are qualified to perform such work. Requiring electricians and power linemen to hold a license results in a safer workplace and a safer public in general. Because the Certificate of Fitness is so important to the IBW, we feel that any exception to its requirement should be narrow and well-defined. We believe that the exception contained in HB 329 is just that. Are there any questions?
I do have a question, actually, Mr. Swanson. So the current statute says employees of an electric utility, and then this bill would add the language, or qualified employees of a local, municipal, or tribal government. So, of course, employees of a local utility might include other members of other trades. And I just wanted to check if you have worked with other affected building trades. And maybe there aren't affected building trades, but has there been coordination with the respective building and construction trade councils to ensure that other affected trades share your interpretation in support of this bill? Thank you.
To the chair, no, I don't believe we've coordinated with any other building trades for their interpretation of this bill, but it does put the onus on the utility by saying qualified employee and then defining it to make sure that that person is competent in the work they're being asked to do.
Okay. Well, I guess my request would be to check, are any non-electrical workers, skilled tradesmen and women affected? And if so, just circle back with us that those respective unions have been consulted on this bill, please.
To the chair, I can do that.
Thank you. I definitely appreciate it. And the bill sponsor can jump in if that coordination has already occurred.
Co-Chair Fields, we have had brief conversations. We didn't have the in-depth conversations like we had with IBEW, but with the pipe fitters, representing the plumbers, the other folks who would be affected, by certificate of fitness changes. I think partly because this limits it to work performed for electric utilities, and electric utilities really have electrical work to be performed. There's not as much concern from them as I understand, but we would be happy to get in touch with them and have a more in-depth conversation.
I appreciate it. I know that my electrical utility is 100% IBW members. I don't know the landscape of all the others, so thanks for checking in. I believe the certificate of fitness language would only be plumbers and electrical workers, but if you don't mind, just confirming that so we have make sure we understand what we're voting on. Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I certainly understand the desire to not hobble AVEC and their ability to do routine maintenance, and requiring a fully qualified, trained, certified journeyman to go out to fix a fuse might be a bad use of resources. So we're going to allow people who are reaching a lower standard, a qualified employee. And on page 2, it says, a qualified employee, a person whose possession of a recognized degree, my question is by whom, or knowledge, training, experience has successfully demonstrated. So my question is, probably to the sponsor, to whose satisfaction must that knowledge be demonstrated, and how would it be demonstrated? And again, just remind us that this is for someone who is an employee of a local, municipal, or tribal government.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Stam would be better qualified to answer that question for Representative Sadler.
Go ahead, Mr. Stam.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, thank you for the question. It is the onus of the employer to make sure that the people that are working for them are provided a safe workplace and are provided the training in order to do the work that they are asked to do. That is in keeping with OSHA standards, and that's basically where that definition of a qualified employee was lifted from. That would be, enforced by Alaska State OSHA or the Department of Labor if they wanted to do an inspection to verify that someone working in that field is qualified to do the tasks that they've been asked to do. But really the onus, as it has been since AVEC started in 68, has always been on the utility to verify that this exemption applies and the people that they have doing the work are trained well enough to perform it safely.
So to follow up, just clarify that. So that's basically you're saying it's the assertion that someone can assert that they have the knowledge, experience to do the work, and that's by the assertion by the employer. I'm sorry, the employer being AVEC, or the employer being who?
Yes, the employer being AVEC.
Okay, so it's up to AVEC to deem somebody qualified to do this. And you say that could be done under DOL, Department of Labor inspection. I don't think everyone's going to be inspected. So I just would like to know more about how AVEC would make sure that the person qualified had some degree of knowledge and how that would be demonstrated. Recognizing the need to get things fixed quickly, too.
So the people that we employ to do this work are trained by our in-house folks. There is training that is also done through AVTEC, for power plant operators, but primarily we have our own staff of power plant operator trainers that would go out, or linemen themselves that would go out and show the person how to do the work, verify that they understand what work they're doing, able to work with the tools that are provided, and actually demonstrate the proficiency in performing the work before we would assign them to do it.
And Mr. Stam, just circling back to my previous question about certificates of fitness, within AVEC, are any non-electrical workers affected by this bill?
Certainly, we have other workers that travel for AVEC that could be given the same training that would not necessarily come under the heading of an electrical worker that would be employed to do, minor tasks. This legislation is focused specifically on facilities that are governed by the National Electric Safety Code and the National Electric Code, and it really doesn't apply to anything plumbing or construction or anything like that. The stipulation under AS 1862.10 is specific to electric facilities.
Okay, Representative Colomb has a question.
So through the chair to the sponsor of the bill. So this area affected isn't your district. So I'm wondering why the representative from the district isn't carrying it if she's in opposition to it in any way.
Through to the chair, to Representative Colomb, I spend a lot of time working with the electric utilities in my role as the co-chair for the House Energy Committee, and it's through that came here. The representative, there's multiple representatives. Yeah. This is a statewide issue. Mm-hmm. Representative next to you, just right. Identify yourself as well. So this came to me as from that role in the legislature.
Okay, so there's no opposition from the reps that are involved?
We've had numerous discussions. Representative Colom, and have not heard any.
Okay.
I can speak to that, Representative Colom. The other co-chair of CRNA is actually very supportive of the bill.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to Mr. Stamm, if you're still on, does AVEC have a roster of people who are living in a village whom you deem qualified, kind of to pre-identify them as qualified individuals, or is that something you would have to do ad hoc?
The individuals that we typically employ are our power plant operators, so we do have a list of those names and their training.
So you would know that they are qualified individuals according to the definition of this bill?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. And a follow-up question, if I may. Is there any potential additional liability to AVEC of deploying people who do not have the full COF? Just thinking about insurance issues, having a full-fledged journeyman to do everything probably lowers your risk and therefore lowers your insurance cost. Is there any additional exposure that we might need to address in this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, again, we've operated under this exception since inception of AVEC, so I don't know that this clarification increases our liability at all.
I would see if not, but I just wanted to ask the question, not leave you hanging out. Mm-hmm.
Okay. This has been a great discussion. Scott Damereau, Chief of Mechanical Inspection, Department of Labor, is also online. Do members have further questions at this time? We do have other bills, so I'm also happy to move on to other bills. Yeah, go ahead, Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair, to the Department of Labor folks that are online. I just want to understand, I understand that a clean interpretation of statute would necessitate that we make this change to allow AVEC to have this exemption, but I'm just wondering why within the last year this is being more narrowly applied and excluding AVEC, and have there been additional incidents where a certificate of fitness would have been essential? Like, can you just give us some context about the decision to make this interpretation?
This is Scott Damereau, Chief of Mechanical Inspection for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and through the chair to Representative Carrick. I'll attempt to explain how this came about. This wasn't a new interpretation for us. What happened is that we became aware that AVEC had picked up the Bethel service area. And we did this through verifying some of their employees applying for certificates of fitness and researching what those employees were doing in the village areas. And I don't remember all of the details specifically, but that led us to finding out that AVEC was outside of the exemption in the statute, because once they had picked up Bethel and added that to their service area, they no longer met the exemption. Now, we did find out about this after the fact. Had we known about it immediately when they picked up Bethel, this would have happened earlier. So that's essentially the trail, the breadcrumb trail to how we got here. And I hope that answers your question.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hall has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Damereau, I might have missed this earlier, but when was it that Bethel got picked up into AVEC?
To the chair, I don't know the exact date of that. That would be a better question for AVEC. We only knew that once we did our research, they had picked up Bethel, and the date that they picked it up wasn't effectively important to us at the time. So that's when we started the discussion, was last year regarding this. I hope that answers the question for you.
I have a quick follow-up.
Of course.
Through the co-chair, Mr. Damereau, can you describe when last year that happened, like even seasonally, summer, fall? Apologies if I missed that when you were speaking previously.
Through the co-chair, I don't have that date with me right now. I could certainly submit it. I would have to research our email communication between myself and AVEC at that time. but I don't have that information handy.
And Mr. Sam, do you want to jump in here and just give the quick history on Bethel and being in AVEX service territory? Thank you.
Yes, through the chair, Bethel became an AVEX territory in 2014, and the notice we received from Department of Labor, I believe, was August of 2025.
Okay.
A long time.
Yeah. the Department of Labor is understaffed. Go ahead, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. But I will throw Mr. Damrow a softball here. Would this bill create, you are the Chief Mechanical Inspection, in your opinion, would this bill create any additional risks to the operation of the local power systems or to the health and safety of the local residents?
Through the co-chair, to Representative Sadler, no, I don't see any additional risks here because the statute as is already allows for this type of work from a smaller company. So AVEX has grown in size to be non-exempted, but another company that didn't have Bethel in their service area would enjoy this full exemption right now under the current law. So I don't see any change. We allow for this work to be done in villages, but the exemption is keyed to the size of the company and their service area, not to the area of work and the geography. So, no, I don't see any additional problem with that. And as far as I've seen, AVEX trains their employees very well and maintains qualifications to the standards that we would expect.
Outstanding. Thank you, sir.
Yep. Okay.
I'm
so sorry. I have one.
That's okay. Go ahead, Representative.
To the co-chair, I just have one more question. I'm, again, not quite sure who it's to. I think probably to Mr. Stamm. So on the Section 1, we have that the certificate of fitness may not be required for the employees of the electric utility or those who are working on behalf of the utility. And just getting back to Rep. Sadler's question earlier about who determines those qualified employees, if they're working on behalf of the utility, is it still the utility that makes that determination, even though they are tribal or local municipal employees potentially? And also, is it the utility that has the liability and not the employer, which in some cases may be the tribal government?
Through the chair, I apologize. I couldn't determine who was speaking.
Sorry, this is Rep. Carrick.
Rep. Carrick, thank you. My understanding is that the liability would be for the utility that is instructing the work. That clause in the language is based around operating agreements that AVEX and possibly other smaller utilities work under in small communities. Often there are few individuals that are trained to do certain types of work, and they may not work directly for the utility. In AVEX instance, we have operating agreements with about half of the communities that we serve. Again, this is something that has been around since AVEX was started, with a desire to keep the community involved in their electric utility. We have operating agreements where the plant operator is actually a city employee, but their wages and tasks are assigned by AVEX. So we reimburse the city with an additional administrative fee to hire those employees and stay involved in the electric utility. So they're on a legal level, they are not a direct employee of AVEX, and that's why we inserted that clause.
Go ahead.
Through the co-chair. So I'm just a little confused in that circumstance. Who would potentially bear liability? Is it would it be the municipal government who's the employer, or is it the utility that's employing them for that specific job?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, the responsibility for operating and maintaining the distribution system lies with the utility.
Okay. I think I'm understanding this correctly. So regardless of whether we have a tribal government employee or a municipal employee working on behalf of the utility, it is the utility as the employer on that job that is assuming liability.
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, yes, that's my understanding as well.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Okay. Not seeing further questions. Representative Plum has a question. Okay. The amendment deadline for this bill is Friday, March 27th at 6 p.m. Next up, House Bill 363, Alcohol Sales by Patriotic Organizations, by Representative Stutes. I think Representative Stutes might not be feeling very well, so her staff is here. Do members have questions for Jane Pearson or for the many of us who heard this bill in a previous committee before we take action on this bill? And Kevin Richard from AMCO, from AMCO is here as well, I believe, online. Okay, not seeing questions. I'm going to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to offer public testimony? I don't see any. I don't see anyone online who wishes to offer public testimony, so I'm going to close public testimony. We did set an amendment deadline for 5 p.m. yesterday and received no amendments. Do members have any further comments before we take action on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Hall, do you have a motion?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report HB 363 Work Order 34-LS1460/G out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Seeing no objection, House Bill 363 does pass from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork and transition to the final bill on today's agenda. At ease. Back on the record, the final bill hearing for today is House Bill 305, Transportation Network Company Driver Pay. I introduced this bill in a previous hearing. We discussed a desire to hear from TNC companies. So thank you, John Finley, who's the Senior Policy and Communications Manager with Uber. Thanks for being here today. Please introduce yourself. And I think one topic that we discussed in the previous committee is what, in your view, are the best models to increase and sustain driver pay based on experience in other jurisdictions. Thanks for being here today, Mr. Finley.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Co-Chair Fields. Thank you, Co-Chair Hall and members of the committee. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all today. I'm from California. My home is in Sacramento. I'm originally from San Diego, so this is actually the furthest north I've ever been in my life, is coming here to visit Alaska, but I've really appreciated the opportunity. It's absolutely beautiful here. We're currently in respectful opposition to the bill as it's currently written. The problem for us is really that we feel the 90% take rate limit included within it kind of fails to recognize what the economics of the platform are and what are the best ways ensure that drivers are earning a fair wage and are earning the best that they can. So some of the examples of where it's working well, I mentioned that I come from California. In 2020, the California voters passed Proposition 22, which included within it a guarantee that workers would remain flexible, would remain independent contractors as opposed to being employees. And that flexibility is really, really essential to why folks choose to earn on platforms like Uber and choose to become transportation network company drivers. The same is true here in Alaska, where the vast majority of drivers choose to earn on the platform for less than 20 hours a week. It is overwhelmingly a part-time gig as opposed to a full-time job. And so California voters reaffirmed that in 2020 with the passage of Prop 22. But it also included within it a earnings standard guarantee. So in California, it's 120% of minimum wage. And then there is also a per mile guarantee. It's 36 cents per mile. And that guarantee guarantee has been effective. And we've seen that not really impact rider demand in the ways that some other proposals around the country have. By contrast, in 2020, the city of Seattle attempted a policy that's similar to the way HB 305 is currently constructed. That was called the Fair Share Pay Standard. The goal was boosting driver pay and setting this new model for gig worker protections, but instead, it really deepened the city's affordability crisis. That piece of legislation, before those regulations were in place, Seattle fares were really in line with the United States average, and after the regulations were passed, fares jumped by more than 40%. So what that looks like now is that riders are paying more, drivers are earning less, and then the pandemic recovery is now lagging. So we have actually seen drivers organize now asking us, or asking their policymakers in Seattle, to limit the number of drivers who can be on the platform so that they're not competing for this now reduced demand. And simply put, if this were to pass the way it's constructed now, with our ability to recoup costs at only 10% of the fare would just rise dramatically. And that would result in decreased rides and decreased opportunity for drivers on the platform, and this service simply not being available in the state of Alaska the way that it is today. So we appreciate the intent, and we're happy to continue conversations. Thank you very much for the conversations that we've had so far, and we're looking forward to continuing those. And any other interested parties in trying to make this work, we're glad to continue talking with.
Yes, let's go to Representative Carrick, and then I have a question too.
Thank you, through the co-chair. Thank you for being here and testifying. I wanted to get at the second part of the co-chair's original question, which is, what is, recognizing some of the challenges from the company perspective, what is the way to increase driver pay, which is also a challenge that this bill is trying to address, and what solutions do TNC companies have for those issues?
Sure. I think one of the best ways is to increase demand, increase the volume of trips that are occurring. We've seen across the country and across the world, the more activity that's happening on the platform, the better driver earnings are. And when there's more demand for rides, and especially in an area where there are perhaps less drivers than there are people wanting a ride, coming into Anchorage, coming into Fairbanks, coming into Juneau, there's the possibility for that economic activity to really grow. So that's number one, is some of the things that can drive demand, really increase driver earnings. And you see in places where supply is outpacing demand, that's when driver earnings really suffer. And that's what I was kind of talking about in Seattle, why Seattle drivers want us to limit the number of drivers on the platforms, because their opportunity to earn is limited by that. So it's really a real-time supply and demand issue. That's number one. But standards, like I was mentioning in California, those tend to work. If there is a earnings standard that the state of Alaska wants to pursue, that is a model that we think has been effective and perhaps could be taken a closer look at. That's one idea. But overall, more activity results in more earnings.
Okay, thank you. Okay. So my question was, how did voters, and as I recall, that was sort of a negotiation with legislators and maybe the governor and companies, how did collectively you all arrive at 36 cents per mile?
Yeah, that was so. It actually, while there were compromises and discussions with legislators, that was a proposition that passed the people of California, and it was an independent initiative that was actually authored by Uber. Participated, several other gig companies participated in writing it. So that was the standard was one that the companies agreed to, and then put that on the ballot for California voters to vote on. And it passed overwhelmingly in 2020, I think with over 65% of the vote. So that was something that was popular with Californians and reflected where negotiations were in the state legislature, but we never got there in terms of the governor and state legislators in California agreeing to that. That was the people of California that set that.
Okay, but what drove 36 cents per mile is 36 cents per mile in addition to the 120% minimum wage?
Or that's an addition, yes. Okay. I honestly would have to go back and see what went into that, just because I wasn't with the company at the time. But overwhelmingly, what I do know is that drivers usually outpace that. That's the minimum earning standard in California. So I can go back and find some details on how that number was cooked up, though.
I want to turn to Representative Frieders. One more follow-up. Can you share data because you probably have at least data on driver pay, say, per hour. However you collect data, can you share data on driver pay before and after that initiative?
Before and after that initiative in California? Yes, I can do that. I don't have that with me today, but I've already put that request into our data folks to get that.
Great. Representative Freer.
Thank you. I just have, a question about what is the minimum wage in California?
It actually varies by locality. The statewide minimum wage, because it just increased, so I don't actually know that number off the top of my head, but it also varies by locality. Cities have their own minimum wage as well, and so it's 125% of whatever the local minimum wage that is set is. So in several jurisdictions, it's actually higher than what the state's is.
Sorry, and through the chair.
First, go ahead.
Follow-up question about the... So is there an opportunity for drivers in California to participate in unemployment or disability insurance or workers' compensation? Or
Well, no, they're independent contractors, as they are in every state in the United States. But there are other benefits that they can opt into. So in California, as part of Prop 22, there is also an optional healthcare stipend that drivers can participate in. There is optional accident insurance that they can purchase as well. And that's all to give these benefits while remaining independent contractors. So things that would be available to employees and mandated under an employment model, the idea was kind of creating a proxy for that they can access even while maintaining the flexibility of being independent contractors. We really see that as being the best of both worlds. And there's a handful of other states that have attempted something similar. Massachusetts comes to mind, although I don't know the details of that one because I focus on California. But yeah, that's kind of how that works.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, and Representative Clum has a question, I think.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, so the bill proposes 90% of the rider's fare. So basically 90% has to go to the rider. How does that, well, first of all, is there other states that has proposed that high? And what do you see from your perspective? What would that do to the fare?
Yeah, thank you for the question. We have not seen anything proposed that high that I'm aware of. The ordinance that I was mentioning in Seattle proposed 80%. Take rate, or a 20% take rate cap on the company, so 80% of the fare the rider pays going to the driver, and that had the economic effects that I was describing of fares jumping by more than 40% in Seattle. So we're anticipating that something similar could happen in Alaska if that were adopted here. I'm not familiar with any other take rate policies that go anywhere near as high in the United States.
A follow up. Hopefully you're familiar with the Alaska market. We heard some testimony from the last committee hearing from very large cities, and we're referencing, you know, California, Seattle, New York, but it's really different here. So why is Uber here? Like, we don't have that many people. I'm just not convinced you're making bank here. But give me kind of some reasoning why you would be in a smaller market, and how these kinds of changes might affect how much you want to be here.
Sure, absolutely. So on a grand scale, Uber, our mission is to reimagine the way the world moves for the better. And we view every opportunity to increase mobility, to try to offer a ride to someone who needs one, to change the way that transportation occurs both in urban centers and in rural areas. That same is true in California, which is our home. That's our global headquarters is in San Francisco. But we're available in rural and in remote and rural areas in California as well. Now, service suffers, and service is not as available in rural areas as it is in urban cores. That is really multiplied here in Alaska, where people are very, very spaced out. We're talking about extremely rural areas where service may not be available. I mean, I didn't even have phone service when I landed at Juneau. Just that's how Alaska works, right? And yet, it is important for us to be here. And we feel that there is an opportunity to continue the availability of these services and connect people who may need a ride to the airport, may need a ride to downtown, wherever it is you need to go. And that's the way that we envision it working in Alaska. However, if it were really that high. And if it were really, I mean, like the economics you're talking about is exactly what we're worried about with the passage of this bill, that it would simply not be worth it to continue to do business in Alaska. That's not a decision I would make. That's a decision the business would make, and I think they would be fair to do so. So that's how I think that would go. But there are ways that we could try to make it work. There are some places in the world where Uber operates as a really like a black car service, where we use a fleet model, and everybody is a commercial driver who owns their own commercial insurance. That's just a significantly smaller and more expensive product than the kind of peer-to-peer product that exists in the United States, where your neighbor who owns a Prius can drive you to the airport if they want to. That kind of model doesn't exist everywhere in the world, but does here in the U.S.
Okay. Yeah, and Representative Clem, the way the price setting works is basically the companies are continuously bidding to the point that they will get drivers to take rides and have an aim for a specified degree of availability, which, you know, in the case of Juneau, that's why it costs $40 to take a ride to the airport, because they're paying their drivers more, and the driver take rate is actually higher in places like Juneau, which is just based on, you know, bidding until you get driver availability. So I think that's how the pay algorithms work for both Uber and Lyft. And obviously, y'all don't disclose the details, but you can correct me if I'm generally wrong about
that. That's generally correct. And if I may add a comment on that, it also that occurs on a per trip basis, right? So there's a lot of factors that go into whether a driver will accept a given trip and whether a rider will pay for it, right? So all of those calculations are made in real time on a per trip basis. And that's why you see the offer fluctuate. And sometimes a driver may be willing to accept less. Sometimes they're willing to accept a whole lot more. And that's what goes into the price fluctuation.
Yeah, and just as a follow-up, Representative Clem, the companies all have an interest in global ubiquity of services, which is why they may continue to service an area, even if it's marginal in terms of contributions to global profits. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Finley, it's the second time I've heard you say that your neighbor might offer rides in your Prius. You just got off the plane, Juneau. My neighbor's got an F-250. Okay, so you're not going to get too many Priuses here, at least. But now that we got you in the witness stand, I'd like to ask you, there's a term I've read in the documentation called upfront pricing. Please describe what upfront pricing is and how it operates.
Sure.
And what it means to people.
Sure. So that's offering the upfront what the price will be to the driver and to the rider on how much the ride is going to cost you and how much the driver is going to earn on that trip, which we previously didn't do. I think we rolled that out 4 years ago now and made it available throughout the entire United States so that we can calculate that in real time, offer to the driver exactly what they're going to make on this trip, and then they accept or decline it on that basis.
Go ahead, Representative.
I want to make sure, did I hear you say what the total, does upfront pricing provide the driver with the total, the fare, and then what percentage of that portion of that fare goes to the driver?
It doesn't provide them with a percentage. It provides them with what they're going to earn on the trip. But yes.
My question is, does it provide what the fare is? For example, I, as the customer, would see what the fare is. It's $20. Would the driver see $20 and you get to 13 or 12 or 10?
No. Okay. The driver sees what the driver is going to earn. So if on a, and this is just a hypothetical example, these numbers wouldn't be exactly, but if on a $20 trip, the rider pays $20 and the driver is going to earn 13, the driver sees 13.
Okay. And follow up on this. And this is the important part. And does that show a breakdown of fees that service charges, other fees that Uber charges? That deducts from the whatever the
yes, it does in the receipt after the trip takes place. In real time, when the offer is being offered, it kind of comes up as a flash notification and just has the number there. You can click on further details to see the breakdown, but in the actual offer, it would just flash the $13, and you would have to look to see further details.
But you continue, so you could actually punch a button and actually see it all there before you accepted the ride, or.
Before you accept the ride, I believe so. If I'm incorrect on that, I'll correct myself afterwards. It's definitely all detailed out in the receipt after the ride, though.
After the ride,
mm-hmm.
Okay. Good job. Thanks.
Yeah, and I'll also, the Prius still remains our most popular vehicle on Uber.
Not here.
Okay, let's go to Francisco Avalos, and then members can continue with questions after that. Mr. Avalos, thanks for being here on Teams, and please proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon, Co-Chair Hall and Co-Chair Fields and members of the committee. My name is Francisco Avalos, Senior Public Policy Manager with Lyft, and I'm here also in respectful opposition to House Bill 305. Lyft does share the goal of ensuring that drivers are fairly compensated and riders have affordable, reliable service. And unfortunately, this bill delivers the opposite. A take rate is by nature dynamic. It reflects real-time market conditions such as driver supply and rider demand. And an artificial floor on driver earnings without like serious discussions of market impacts will likely result in higher fares and therefore lower demand, as my colleague has noted. I will note that Alaska drivers do have some of the highest earning rates in the country for engaged hour. Now, an engaged hour is when you're either dispatched out to go complete a ride or when you're actually in an actual ride. It's actually sixth in the nation. And so that this bill puts that at risk. And that's because driver earnings are a function of ride volume, not just per trip earnings. And so fewer rides means fewer trips and therefore potentially lower overall earnings for the very driver the bill is trying to help. So they may make more per ride with the take rate, but in general, they'll make less overall because more broadly demand would just fall. And so what makes this bill particularly damaging is that it also just does not account for external fees. And so these are the ride costs that go into that go neither to the driver or Lyft. So in Alaska, these external costs are like state mandated insurance costs, taxes, government fees, credit card processing fees. And that in itself is already above that 10% threshold. Therefore, we would be operating at a loss on every single ride. And so then, because that would then compress the margins and we still have to address these fixed costs, of course, that's what ultimately is what drives fares up. And that ultimately impacts the most vulnerable populations. And so what we know nationwide in Alaska, because ride volume is relatively low, we don't have data specific to Alaska, enough for it to be scientifically that we can stand behind. But more broadly nationwide, about 41% of rides, you know, begin in low-income areas. 28% of our riders use Lyft to get to healthcare appointments. And others use it, of course, to get to work and other meaningful kind of places. So we urge the committee to consider a no vote. Happy to answer any particular questions around the bill. We're also open to have a thoughtful conversation about what driver earnings could look like in Alaska. We have seen take rate bills pop up in other jurisdictions as well. And unfortunately, that per ride limit just makes the dynamics really hard and unfortunately unable for us to operate in a market with a take rate cap, particularly this high. So happy to jump into any particular questions and
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Avalos. Would you agree that the California structure of sort of a linkage to minimum wage with a per mile floor works for your drivers in California? I mean, I assume it does because you're operating there. Do you think that is a better model?
Yeah, I think there are several. There's different models that have been negotiated across the country that are just specific to the market dynamics, right? I don't have enough of the specifics to determine like what structure would be best for Alaska. But certainly, of course, you know we're fully engaged in the negotiations in California and are aligned with that model.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm just asking. It seems like the California model works for you. Are there any additional models you're aware of that you would suggest that we look to as functional models that have shown that they work in at least, say, one jurisdiction somewhere?
I'm happy to follow up with like specifics, but no particular model that we would recommend here. We frankly, transparently feel pretty strongly that driver earnings are really high in the market. On average, drivers are earning about $38 an hour per engaged hour. Again, that's that time to go to when they're dispatched to a particular ride and when they're in an actual ride. Alaska, of course, has unique dynamics. It's not New York City. It's not Los Angeles. It's not San Francisco. Volume isn't as high. So there is sometimes a little bit more weight in between rides. as well as distance. Now, that said, when a rider is dispatched to a ride, from the moment they're dispatched to the moment they complete the ride, they're being paid for that time.
Yeah, Mr. Avalos, I think that number is probably inaccurate or misleading, and I'll explain why. So I take Lyft from my house to the airport to commute here. Typically, the driver drives 10 to 12 minutes from wherever they are to my house, and then I pay them, it's about $25 that I pay from my house in downtown Anchorage to the airport. The average driver pay rate for Lyft and Anchorage is consistently about 45% of the fare. The driver gets about 45% of the fare. I interview all my drivers. So the driver earns about, you know, maybe $12 to $13. Of course, I tip generously because I can. But, you know, that driver is working well over 30 minutes and earning, if they're lucky, $15 before expenses. So I don't see how it would – and that's a very standard ride, you know, airport to midtown, airport to downtown. The driver pay rate for Lyft is much lower for longer rides. So the driver pay rate for Lyft, if you take a long ride from, say, the Anchorage airport to the Matanuskas to Sitna Valley, the driver pay rate is typically under 40%. So Lyft takes more than 60%. And that's a very long deadhead ride, obviously, if you're driving back from the valley to Anchorage. So I would be curious about how you calculate the $38, because I think it's probably not representative of what drivers are actually earning.
Representative Fields, we stand by our data. That is what drivers are earning per engaged hour. Again, that is from the time that a rider requests a ride and is matched with a driver, from the moment a driver is matched with that rider and begins to head towards that ride to the moment that they finish the ride.
So your contention is $38 per hour, you're counting the time that the driver is driving to pick up the rider.
Correct. So there's three different periods when a ride is going on. There is the first period in which a rider maybe just a driver may be waiting to be matched. There is a time when then they're matched with the actual rider and dispatched to the ride. And then there's the time when the rider is actually in the vehicle en route to their destination. So for the engaged time, it's the second and third period.
Okay. Representative Carrick and Colomb have questions. Go ahead, Representative Carrick.
Yes, I think this is maybe for both of our Lyft and Uber representatives here. I similar to Co-Chair Fields, I'm going to, I guess, kind of dispute. We have some news articles here, and granted, they're not written by Uber and Lyft, so they're not necessarily glowing reviews, but that would suggest that the take rate is significantly lower by both dollar amount and percentage than $36 an hour. And so it's hard for me to know what to believe with that data. And I guess I'd like to ask, maybe could both entities provide for this committee the average driver pay in comparing two states, perhaps California and Alaska. Additionally, the average per hour driver pay. I think it would be helpful to see the mode as well, like the most common hourly wage, because there are a lot of variable factors that would, you're going to have drivers that are driving extraordinary amounts. They're working, you know, 20 of 24 hours sometimes. And so they're going to skew the data. And I do think it would be helpful to see the average per hour wage, and then alongside that also see the most common per hour wage. So I'd kind of like both the average and the mode, maybe for both your California drivers and for your Alaska drivers. And if there's another way to break down that data, I'd be interested to see it too.
Does that sound good?
Yeah. Okay. Response, which one of us you want to go first?
It doesn't matter. Go ahead, John.
Okay, sure.
If you know that information off the top of your head, otherwise we could have it brought back to us. I also just wanted to note that California's minimum wage is $16.90 per hour as of January 1st of this year.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And then also, so I heard you would request the mode, the most common. So can you clarify that for me a little bit, just so I can go back to my people and bring back the right number? So you're asking for the most common fare, the most common hourly like for an individual driver, what the Okay.
Most common hourly pay as well as the average hourly pay.
Okay. I have our average hourly pay today, which is in Q4 of 2025, it was $40 an hour for Uber.
Mr. Finley, is that in Alaska?
In Alaska, yes. And I don't have California in front of me yet, right now.
Yeah. And are you counting that as the time that a driver responds to or commits to a ride to the time that they drop off?
Yes, yes. Calculated the same way that our colleagues from Lyft calculated it. Okay.
Representative Colomb, and then Freer, and then Hall, and then Sadler.
Well, I kind of had a different question, so I didn't
know more of a
if you wanted to respond
Go ahead.
About this.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, through the chair. My question is a follow-up to Representative Carrick's question. Can you also, do you have a breakdown of the communities? I come from Akavik. It's a small community. We don't have Uber or Lyft up there. And just another note, you know, you said the best way to increase rates or pay is to increase demand, but we have a population of less than 1 million. I don't know how we increase demand, but I'm just curious if you could break that down, like Juneau compared to Anchorage, compared to Fairbanks and the communities that use Uber and Lyft and what those rates are. I assume there are more drivers. There are absolutely more drivers in Anchorage. But when I ride Uber or Lyft, and usually it's Uber because Uber is about half the price of a Lyft in Juneau, I often get the same driver. I get the same driver all the time. He's like right here at 5 o'clock on a Monday, Wednesday, or Friday. So just curious what that breakdown would kind of look like.
Sure. Yeah, I can take that back. I'm sure Lyft will feel the same. Yeah, I'd have to go back to get a breakdown by community or by city. I imagine it's by city of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, which are the cities that we operate in. But then kind of going back to this question about the mode, let me make sure I'm understanding correctly. So this would be the most common hourly wage. We'd have to think about that a little bit. It's a little bit complicated to get. But I will certainly take that back to our data science folks and try to have something for you.
Okay. Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a question for Mr. Finley. So I made a district trip home on March 14th, and I went from the airport to my house, which is a very quick trip. I ended up paying $21.93, and according to the receipt, if I'm following your instructions correctly, I see that the trip fare was $20.46, and there was a booking fee for $1.47, totaling the $21.93. What does the driver get?
What you're asking what the driver made on that individual ride? Yeah, I wouldn't be able to answer that. We showed the driver on that ride what they made. We don't do a breakdown of what the driver gets to the customer, so that's not showing on your receipt. What I was saying before is that the driver would be able to see on the receipt how much was going to other fees like you were breaking down. So there's a driver receipt that shows what they got and then the other fees on top of it, and then there's a customer receipt that shows what you paid and the other fees on top of it. So it would be a portion of that, of the fare, of the $20.93 or whatever that was.
Follow up?
Yes.
Through the co-chair. Mr. Finley, so what are the fees within the trip fare that I'm not seeing on here? Because all I see is the trip fare for $20.46, and then on top of that, a booking fee of $1.47.
Sorry, because I'm not looking at your receipt. It says...
There's a trip fare for $20.46. So mm-hmm. if a portion of that is the driver's fare, what fills in the gulf between the driver fare and whatever that $20.46 is?
Sure. Well, some of it comes to Uber as to cover our costs of maintaining the app, to cover... there might have been... You said it was a ride to the airport, right?
Airport to my house.
Okay. Which do you mind me asking which airport this was?
Ted Stevens, Anchorage International Airport.
In Anchorage, okay. Yeah, I don't believe Anchorage right now has an airport fee. On other rides, and I know in Juneau there is a fee for picking up and dropping off at the airport, so that could be that in a given example, not necessarily on your receipt. But in a given example, it could go to an airport fee, could go to a toll that a driver passed by. All of these things would then be displayed on the receipt as well. But on your individual ride, what Uber recouped back to cover its costs of providing the ride are out of that fare, out of the $43 I think you said.
The trip fare was $20.46.
46 cents.
So if you had to guess through the chair, what percentage would the driver have received?
Sorry, I'm not going to guess without looking at the numbers. I'd really have to, if I was looking at the receipt, I could probably give you a solid answer of that.
I'm happy to share this with you.
Thank you. Yeah.
After the committee meeting.
Thank you. Yes, sorry, my math of just remembering those numbers is not
quite all right. And Mr. Co-Chair, I just have a comment, and this is a comment. I mentioned this on the record during our last hearing, I believe, and just for your awareness, I typically take cabs home when I go back to district because I know that it's a solid, like, between $13 and $15. That's what I'm going to be paying. And so I was quite surprised when instead of about a 15, let's say, generously, cab ride, I would have had to go, what is it, just 2.93 miles. It was a seven-minute drive. I ended up paying $7 more to take an Uber. So I think I'll be sticking with cabs for now.
Okay. Thank you for your consideration.
Representative Coloma and then Sadler.
Okay, so I appreciate all the anecdotal stories going on here, but I'll be curious to see what you come up with the pay and that analysis of that. So I wanted to give both testifiers an opportunity to respond to some of the things that were said about you in the last committee meeting, and you weren't here. And so what I have is what was said was that your drivers are earning less than the minimum wage. The model's built on a poverty model. It fleeces the consumer, impoverishes the driver, and many platform workers don't have the same freedoms that independent contractors are supposed to have.
Sure, I'll go first. We dispute each of those points wholeheartedly. I think on a data level, we dispute the fact that we dispute the claim that drivers are not making minimum wage. As I shared in Q4 of 2025, for the engaged time, it was around $40 an hour, which we consider to be good and fair, and obviously can be increased with more activity and more rides available. We also dispute the idea that this is a poverty model that is fleecing consumers. I mean, certainly sometimes Ubers can be more expensive than other ways to get around. Sometimes they're cheaper than other ways to get around. That's the dynamic pricing model that I was talking about that helps to have rides be available. But it's generally a service that people have appreciated and is growing in popularity, not shrinking. So we stand by that and are constantly working to make it better. And then as far as the drivers and preserving that flexibility and the flexibility that an independent contractor has, it's as simple as turning off the app, which is the thing that we hear our drivers love the most, is the flexibility that the minute you don't want to keep doing rides, you simply turn off the app and then you don't have to anymore, as opposed to us setting a schedule and giving you a requirement for a certain number of rides you have to take. So that is the main reason a lot of folks continue to choose to continue earning on platforms like Uber.
Avalos, did you want to respond to that?
Sure. I mean, of course, we vehemently, deny those categorizations. Our drivers are really dynamic individuals who have a myriad of different needs, and we know that they value several things, including, as my colleague here mentioned, the flexibility. We have parents who caretakers who need flexibility in their ability to earn. We have students who are able to flex how they earn. We have teachers on the platform who during breaks or during summers or whenever they might have extra times have earning opportunities and capacities. An overwhelming majority of drivers are driving on the platform, less than 20 hours a week, earning like I said, $38 an hour on average pre-tips in Alaska. And so we also consider that to be, of course, fair. Drivers are earning 100% of their tips. They're keeping everything that is being shared with them by riders. And so it's really a two-sided marketplace that is really dynamic, right? It creates an opportunity for an individual to earn on their terms using sometimes one of their most expensive assets, which is their vehicle, to be able to earn on their terms. On the other side of it, of course, you have a community who needs access to transportation, and this helps people in community a lot of times help complete those rides, right? So in areas that are a little bit more rural or isolated, you have people in community being able to actually help deliver transportation to those individuals in that community. So we very much stand by it. We think it helps support the infrastructure of communities across the country, and it provides hundreds of thousands of earning opportunities for individuals across the country as well. So we very much deny those claims or categorization and feel that drivers are choosing to earn with us every day. And it's our responsibility as platforms to ensure that, you know, we're doing everything we can to contain cost so that we can maximize earning opportunities for drivers while ensuring a fair marketplace for riders as well.
Representative Sadler is next, and then Carrick.
Thank you.
And then Nelson.
To both the gentlemen, what are the minimum standards or qualifications, training, credentials for a driver for your transportation network corporation service?
I'd have to look into the specifics if there's any nuances for Alaska, but typically it's a vehicle that's less than 15 years old and has some minimum standards requirements met. They have to, of course, have a valid driver's license. There's background checks associated with it before they're onboarded onto the platform. And then there's some general learnings that kind of have to occur in order to just learn how to function on the app and work the app itself, how earnings work, you know, how the app itself works. And then there's a library of content that individuals can go and access on a myriad of topics. On whether it's, you know, maximizing earnings or other strategies as well as things around service animals and other things of that nature.
Exactly the same on Uber. I believe there are statutory requirements in Alaska for what those onboarding what onboarding looks like. But then, additionally, I want to highlight the availability of safety tools as well and education around safety, which is paramount on the app. And there's lots of those kind of learning modules that my colleague was mentioning available on safety specifically.
And the follow up: do they have to have commercial driver's licenses, a certain level of insurance over the state minimum?
So drivers are standard license is there's no commercial license requirement. They do have to maintain insurance on the vehicle. That means the minimal financial standards in the state, and then commercial insurance that at the expense of the companies, which is one of the costs that is subtracted from a fare, is held for rides. I believe during the time of a rider or driver's dispatched and a driver's in the, or riders in the car,
Okay. And I just want to clarify on that, if I might. So the commercial insurance purchased by the transportation network company, either Uber or Lyft, is in effect from the time the driver accepts a ride to the time they drop off a passenger. Is that accurate? Okay. Thank
That's
you.
That's correct.
Okay. And Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the co-chair. And I'm just wondering, for our company representatives, have you also factored into the take-home federal self-employment taxes and the deductions that people are having to do there? Because in Alaska, there's a 15.3% federal self-employment tax in addition. So is that factored into what the driver takes home?
That's a good question. I don't actually know the answer to that. I'll confirm that and come back.
Okay. I just think... follow up.
Yeah.
Through the chair, I think that that's worth, if it's not included in your calculations, I understand, but it's something that the committee should be thinking about. I know a couple of Uber drivers up at home, and ultimately they make less than 40% of their earnings on the platform. And a lot of that has to do also with federal tax that they pay after the fact. And I did just have one other question. I'm hearing the testimony from both Uber and Lyft, and I am just curious, is The number 90% for minimum compensation in this bill is very high. Is there a number that is supported? Is there a lower number, or is it just general opposition to instituting minimum compensation, period?
I would say that from Lyft's perspective, a take rate is just not the right mechanism to have a conversation around driver earnings. Certainly 90% is through the roof, but there's not, on a per ride basis, there's not a cap, that number that works for the business, right? Like the marketplace is very dynamic. And so likely why the ride was more expensive this time versus last time is a function of supply and demand. And in some cases, drivers maybe need to be further incentivized to provide that quality experience for the rider, which is what they care about, right? Ensuring that they arrive at their location on time, that they're not waiting too long. So there's occasions where on a ride we may lose money. And then in other rides where there is a little bit more of a larger take from the business. But the idea is balancing out earnings so that there is a consistent earnings as best as it can be for drivers. And so a take rate mechanism for Lyft just does not work. So there's unfortunately not a number that we could get to that we would be that we think would work for on a per ride basis for a dynamic marketplace.
If I could just jump in for a second. So Mr. Avalos, I was in Barcelona recently, and Lyft drivers there earn 85% of the fare. So I mean, it's just interesting to me, when Uber and Lyft came to Alaska in 2018, the drivers earn 90%. So it's interesting to me, because drivers have had a higher take rate at certain times in certain jurisdictions. And, you know, honestly, I'm persuaded that a driver earning rate might not be the best metric, but it has worked both in Alaska and other jurisdictions. Go ahead, Representative Carrick.
Yeah, just to follow up and add on to that, you know, I like that Uber and Lyft are operating in Alaska. I don't want to see them go away. And I'm not convinced that the rate in this bill is the right rate. But I do want to ask our Lyft testifier representative the same question I'd asked earlier. If this isn't the right mechanism to increase driver pay, what is the right mechanism? And we basically just heard earlier, just have it continue to be an open market platform. And I'm not convinced that that's really the solution either. So do you have any concrete solutions to increase driver pay besides that?
I don't have any specific framework that to offer today for Alaska. There's a lot of nuances that go into determining what could or wouldn't work in this particular marketplace. That said, we do feel very strongly that the mechanisms that are in place in Alaska, leading to drivers earning sixth highest in the nation, are working. And so we would certainly be open to a conversation around driver earnings. I'm not prepared to have that conversation today, but a take rate is not going to get us there. Unfortunately, what happens is when we set these artificial kind of a driver pay earning standard may work better, that may provide more flexibility. And we may get to a point where drivers are earning more per ride. That could happen, but we could also get to a point where drivers are earning more per ride, but earning less overall, because demand falls and there's price increases on a, and that creates like an affordability issue for riders. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, do you have, I'm sorry. Representative Nelson was next. Go ahead, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to touch on a couple different things, of course, speaking as someone that previously was a driver for Uber, I'm a little biased just because I've been through that front line of seeing, one, what it goes for drivers and riders and what their experience is like and what their take-home pay. And also having traveled internationally, I know that Spain's laws are a little bit different than American laws, so that might mean why the Uber out in Spain is a little bit different than an Uber out here in Alaska. One of the things I really wanted to hit on that we talked about today, and Mr. Avalos and Mr. Finley touched on a little bit, was just looking about the open market. One of the jokes for a lot of drivers, especially in the Anchorage area, is you can either have really good time driving or you can make a lot of money driving. You can't necessarily overlap both of them. And that joke comes from a couple drivers that exclusively will only drive Friday nights, Saturday nights, sometimes Sunday nights, and that is strictly to the bars. And you have to worry about someone puking your car and getting a $50 cleanup fee, or you have to worry about people stumbling in and out of a driveway, maybe not getting home as easier as you want them to. But you earn a lot more money because you're willing to stay up till 3 a.m. and drive people home from the bars compared to what I did, where it was a nice, easy 7 to like 5 p.m. and I just go take elders to their doctor's appointments or people to their work or soldiers that wanted to go off base. It was easier. It wasn't as great of a pay as, say, people that went and did the bar scene. But it was a lot more flexible, or I could go and interact with people on a much easier characteristic. Also, for Representative Hall's point about having a taxi, I use taxis extensively as well. The issue that comes up is at least taxis in Anchorage, they always take a while whenever you try to call them. So I've waited anywhere between 20 minutes and an hour in the cold waiting for a taxi to come in. And the good thing about Uber and Lyft, both seeing as a driver and as a user, is that you can literally watch them drive up to you and see the multitude of cars that are nearby. And also going into safeness and cost, I have had plenty of taxi drivers that mistakenly went the wrong way, or you did a U-turn where they shouldn't have, and that increased the cost. Compared to when you're on Uber or Lyft, where you can see the route that person's taking and the driver, we don't gain any benefits for making a wrong turn or stopping early or doing something different. As someone that maybe is a little bit easier and don't have to worry about safeness, I can speak for my fiance who has had incidents in taxis where she has felt unsafe and had to step out, compared to Uber and Lyft where they do have tools for rider safety, rider recording, that kind of thing. So I just wanted to put that on the record and talk about that. And Mr. Avalos, Mr. Finley, you're welcome to add anything additionally.
Sure. Thank you very much for those comments. And then also, I really just wanted to highlight the last point you made around safety and that being a paramount priority for our company and constantly improving those tools all of the time. Just a little bit about myself. Prior to coming to Uber, I worked for the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault that represented all of the rape crisis centers in California. How I came to Uber was that companies like Uber and Lyft were actually consulting with organizations like the one I used to work for on how to make the product better and how to investigate and respond to issues of sexual harassment, sexual misconduct. That is where my career started. And one of the reasons I bring that up is simply because we have improved those safety tools dramatically in that time and continued to roll out new ones, new features that are very popular with users and help to keep people safe. But fundamentally, the technology helps to keep people safe as well in tracking every ride and the ability to share that ride with a trusted contact, as well as what you were saying, just the fact of the folks who might have had a little too much to drink and were out at the bars, they're now no longer driving on the roads. They have the ability to get into an Uber or Lyft and have that come quickly, and they're not waiting around saying, hey, I'll just drive myself. It really, we have seen it, and that's another data question. We've seen it transform communities, especially in reducing drunk driving.
Okay.
One,
thank you so much for driving on the platform and being a rideshare driver. I was the opposite of you. I was a driver for about 2.5 years, and I would, you know, have my family date nights from my normal job on Fridays, and then I would go out on Friday nights and drive those hours in my community as well. But to your point, like, there are significant investments that are made in-app that make transportation more accessible. And to your point on, you know, ensuring the experience on both sides of the marketplace, right? We want to ensure that when riders are requesting a ride, they're not waiting too long, and that they have that access to their job or to their doctor's appointments, that they arrive there on time. And that's where, like, that dynamic marketplace is really kind of important, because if there's a driver that's far away, you could incentivize them a little bit more to be willing to ensure that that experience happens for a rider versus leaving an area completely inaccessible and focusing on city centers or whatever the case might be. Nothing else to add to that point other than absolutely correct. There's continuous investment on a myriad of tools to make the experience overall better.
All right. Well, there are children waiting for us to finish this hearing. So thank you for being here today. I am gonna appreciate the feedback both from representatives of drivers and the companies, and I will be drafting a CS for members to consider that takes into account a wide range of feedback. We will next meet Friday at 3:15. At 4:49, Labor and Commerce is adjourned.